the third case of the day, the United States versus Ross and Wilson. Ms. Mather.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. The first thing I'd like to do today is simply request that the Court permit supplemental briefing regarding the Supreme Court's recent decision in Cunningham versus California. That case, I believe, presages some additional Supreme Court involvement in determining whether the remedial opinion of Booker will continue to be good law, particularly in circuits like this one where guidelines calculations are presumptively reasonable. I would simply ask that the Court permit supplemental briefing on that point, and if the Court would rather that I file a motion to that effect and the Court could rule on that by mail, that would be...
Just what type of supplemental briefing are you seeking?
I don't think we need any more than 10
pages. Citation of the case? All you want to do is call our attention to the case?
I apologize, Your Honor, I didn't...
All you want to do is call our attention to the existence of the case?
Your Honor, what I'd like to do is brief why the Supreme Court's decision in Cunningham versus California indicates that Mr. Ross's sentence would have been imposed in violation of the Fifth and Sixth Amendments to the Constitution.
You'd think that we'd be unable to read that out of the case if we read the case ourselves.
Certainly not, Your Honor. If Your Honors would prefer that I simply call the Court's attention to the case and in Rule 28J, I would be happy to do that.
It strikes me that should be sufficient. But
Yeah, I think that would be fine.
Oh, thank you, Your Honors, and we'll make sure that we file that letter today or Monday at the latest. Thank you. What I'd like to address first today with regard to the substance of Mr. Ross's appeal is the district court's failure to sever the felon in possession count. What happened here essentially was that Mr. Ross was charged with robbery of a postal truck and conspiracy to rob a postal truck, and then also use of a firearm in furtherance of a crime of violence, again related to robbery of the postal truck. In addition, there was a count four related to being a felon in possession of certain ammunition that was found 5 months later than the time of the alleged robbery when Mr. Ross was arrested in his home. And as we articulate in our briefs, there's simply nothing on the face of the indictment that connects the felon in possession count to the remaining counts of the indictment. And based on that, this is a strict issue of law for the Court to observe on the face of the indictment what is alleged and then to determine as a matter of law whether those counts are permitted to be joined. And I think as this Court has demonstrated in the past, the joinder requirement, at least as a matter of law on the Rule 8 side, simply requires that there be that the offenses be of a same or like character or that the offenses be related in some common scheme or plan. There's no allegation by the government that there's some common scheme or plan going on here, and that certainly doesn't appear from the face of the indictment either. And the offenses, as we articulate in our brief, felon in possession of ammunition, do not relate to in any statutory or element type way to robbery of a postal truck. In that sense, the count simply should not have been allowed to be joined. Furthermore, even moving on to the Rule 14 analysis, Mr. Ross was clearly prejudiced by the joinder in that the jury was repeatedly informed that he was a felon, and that status certainly must have impacted the jury's assessment of Mr. Ross's crime in general. In addition, Your Honors, we have a failure to the district court failed to grant Mr. Ross's motion to suppress, and I think there we have certain issues that even taking the agent's testimony as credible certainly implicate whether Mr. Ross's will was overborne and whether he was coerced into making the statement that he made sitting in his apartment only minutes after the agents had stormed in with a German Shepherd and a submachine gun, ordered him out of his house and cleared the area. There was simply no dispute that the agents had in fact pointed the gun at him, although they said that they had pointed the flashlight at him, which was simply on the end of the barrel of the gun. There was no dispute as to that. So in fact, the gun was pointed at Mr. Ross. There was some dispute.
Flashlight was on the barrel of the gun.
That's correct, Your Honor.
My gollies, I thought I'd seen everything. Was this an exhibit in the trial?
I don't know, Your Honor. I didn't scour the record for that, but I would think not. I would think that the submachine gun would not have been admitted as an exhibit for the jury to see at the trial.
Count the day lost when you don't learn something. But I didn't know.
And I think that the agents, I don't think there was any dispute as to the makeup of the submachine gun, but given that even the agents admitted that, at least from Mr. Ross's perspective, the gun was certainly pointed at him and only moments separated that from the interrogation of Mr. Ross, clearly that's relevant or should have been relevant to the district court's determination as to whether or not the motion to suppress should be granted. One of the more disturbing things about the district court's analysis in this circumstance was that she simply asserted that there was no physical intimidation or physical abuse, and that alone justified the denial of the motion to suppress. We would simply assert that the district court failed to address these other aspects that were raised by the agent's own testimony and in that sense abused her discretion.
Didn't the district court find, Ms. Mather, that it was 25 minutes after that forced entry before the interrogation commenced?
Well, she found the agent's testimony credible, but the agent's testimony differed on that point. There was one agent who testified it was 10 minutes. There was one agent who testified it was about 25. So there was some dispute as to that, and I don't think that the district court specifically resolved, I believe, this agent over that agent with regard to the time period.
Well, as to the defendant's will, there was the initial denial of involvement, right? We have this forced entry, pretty dramatic, and obviously traumatic, perhaps, and yet the defendant is resistant to the position that he committed a crime. So, I mean, we do have, despite those circumstances, a defendant possessed of enough will to resist the suggestion that he was involved.
Well, certainly, Your Honor, Mr. Ross did initially deny that he had any involvement in the robbery. I would simply indicate to the court that there's certainly nothing in the case law that would penalize a defendant or determine
that. I'm not suggesting there's anything wrong in his position. I'm just suggesting it does, looking at the totality, if we're going to focus on police conduct in the nature of the entry, it is reasonable also, I suppose, for the district court to look at the whether the will is overborne in light of that. That's my only thing. I'm not critical of anything that the defendant said at that point.
I certainly understand that, Your Honor, and certainly the test is a totality of the circumstances test. But again, our contention is that the district court's analysis was so narrow and so limited that she failed to analyze how the agent's own testimony demonstrated that Mr. Ross's statement was in fact involuntary. I see that I've entered my rebuttal time, and without any further questions, I'll.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Mather. Ms. Garth?
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Hannah Garst. I represent Defendant Appellant Derek Wilson in this case. I'd just like to take the first minute to bring the court's attention to the 28J letter I filed this Wednesday. I apologize for the late filing, but I just wanted to reaffirm that we believe that Mr. Wilson cannot overcome the plain error standard based on the fact that his sentence does not exceed the consecutive statutory max. For the two counts that he was found guilty of, therefore, reversal is unwarranted. So I just wanted to bring the court's attention to that. We believe that the district court here abused its discretion when it allowed the evidence related to the 97-98 robberies of the post office to be put into evidence. And the issues here are whether that the prior robberies are intricately related to the 2003 offense and whether it's admissible under 404B. We do not believe it's intricately related because Mr. Johnson's testimony does not complete the story of the charged offense here. We believe that the 97-98 evidence had more to do with Johnson's actual testimony than the 2003 robbery itself. We pointed to United States versus Owens, and the reason why we feel that it's similar in this case is because that the government is basically saying that the evidence is intricately related to Johnston's testimony, their main witness in this case. In Owens, the facts are similar in that Davis, one of the defendants, testified that Owens had robbed the same bank before. Now, this court went on to say that all the government needed in that case was testimony from the from Davis regarding the fact that Owens had specified that he had been at that bank before. We believe the same is true here, that the government needed testimony that Wilson was a post office employee, that Johnson had asked Wilson in the past about whether the post office had money, its location in the post office, and that Wilson had explained the whereabouts. The problem here is that the government went too far in talking about the 97 and 98 robberies.
Well, if we agree with you on the intricately related and say that it didn't, that that wasn't a correct ruling, you still have to deal with the 404B, evidence of the other bad acts used to prove opportunity or knowledge. So why wouldn't it be admissible there?
Well, Your Honor, we believe that the government can't meet the first test to show that the propensity, that they didn't put it into evidence to show propensity here. We don't believe that the 97-98 evidence had a strong resemblance to the 2003 crime. There's definitely differences in that. It was a different place in the post office. There was a different number of men used. Johnson also testified that he never intended to use Mr. Wilson in the third robbery, and that the only reason Mr. Wilson was called was due to the fact that Ross's car was broken down on the second time that they were going to rob the post office. So we do not believe that there is a resemblance there. I see I've gone into rebuttal. I'd like to save the rest. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Darcy. Mr. Schneider?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Your Honor, with respect to Defendant Wilson, this is not the Owens case. The evidence that was admitted in this case was inextricably intertwined with the offense that was charged here. I'm sorry, Judge?
That's a tough thing to say.
It is. I apologize. And that evidence was important, Your Honors, because that described the relationship that existed between Johnston and Mr. Wilson, described the origin of the trust that existed between them, what the basis of that trust was. And that trust was essential to accomplishing the purposes of their conspiracy. This is not the Owens case. The Owens case is a run-of-the-mill bank robbery, a run-of-the-mill demand note bank robbery in which there is no specific information required. It requires very general knowledge, simply the location of a bank. In contrast, the information that Wilson had in this case was the when, the where, and the how, all of which was very specific to the crime that they were attempting to commit here. In addition, Owens is a case that does not involve a conspiracy count. A conspiracy is a specific intent crime where the defendant puts the government to its burden at trial. In a specific intent crime, the intent is necessarily at issue. The evidence here, even aside from the inextricably intertwined theory, was relevant to show the relationship between Johnson and Wilson, to show Wilson's very detailed and specific knowledge of the bank, the opportunity he had to rob it, as well as his identity, as illustrated by the common modus operandi that permeated all three of these robberies.
Let me just ask you one question about the earlier robberies. Isn't it a bit unfair to elicit testimony regarding the 1998 robbery, despite the potential for confusion and waste of time, and then rely on that to preclude Wilson from bringing in his own evidence regarding the robbery?
Well, Judge, I think the defense in their reply brief conceded the question about that additional robbery, which was the issue about the scissors and the prosecution of somebody incorrectly. And I think the judge's ruling on that issue was that they could raise it during and after the testimony of Mr. Johnson if they chose to do that, and they didn't do that. I don't think that evidence was relevant in the first place, but he may well have been able to challenge that testimony had he had evidence to do so, but he didn't have evidence to do so. So I think the defense has conceded that issue on appeal. With respect to Mr. Johnston, both of the severance motions are waived in this case. Under the Seventh Circuit law, the courts held in Taglia and other cases that the failure to renew a motion for severance at the close of the evidence waives the objection, and there is no such removal here. At the close of the evidence, the defendant has two choices. They have to make a choice. They can either renew the motion, and if they prevail, potentially face two new trials, or they can let the matter be submitted to the jury and see what happens. What they can't do is engage in the sort of gamesmanship that happened here, where he gets to eat his cake and have it too, and the unrenewed severance motion, in effect, serves as an insurance policy against an adverse verdict. And if the other factor that I think is relevant to the severance and the failure to renew the severance motion is that the analysis that the Court of Appeals considers, if there is an error with respect to improper joinder, is an actual prejudice analysis. And it makes sense that the district court ought first to have the opportunity to assess whether there has been actual prejudice. And the time at which the district court can do so is at the conclusion of the evidence in the trial. And that's why the rule in this court requires the renewal of the motion, which didn't happen here, and why both severance claims are therefore waived. With respect to the joinder of counts, those counts are properly joined for two reasons. The first reason is that the charge of possession of a firearm is charged in count three of the indictment, that is, possession of a firearm in furtherance or connection to a crime of violence, and possession of ammunition is necessarily of the same or similar character. They're both firearms offenses. They're both criminal firearms offenses. In addition, though, the face of the indictment suggests that the offenses are at bare minimum connected with a common scheme. That is to say, that count one, the conspiracy account, alleges that Ross is the gunman in the robbery, that he used the firearm, and that he returned to his residence after the robbery. And that's the same residence where that ammunition was recovered. In addition, though, there was no actual prejudice to the defendant, even if the joinder were improper, which it was not. There was substantial overlap with the evidence. That certainly the gun evidence, the ammunition evidence, would have come in a bifurcated trial or in two separate trials. The victim described the revolver as being small. The ammunition that was found in this case were 25 caliber pistol bullets, what was charged, as well as 22 caliber bullets, both small caliber ammos. There was no gun recovered, so certainly the evidence, and this was argued by the government in its closing, that ammunition was found in the defendant's house was relevant to whether or not the defendant was using a firearm in connection with the robbery. In addition, the court presumes that that the jurors follow limiting instructions. The jurors were properly instructed on that issue in this case, and there's no reason to believe they would not have followed those instructions. If the court has no further questions, the government will rest on its brief.
Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Ms. Mather.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll just address briefly the waiver issue. I think particularly with regard to Rule 8, that should be a non-starter for the government. Rule 8 is reviewed on the face of the indictment. The government has cited no case law that actually articulates that a Rule 8 motion for severing the counts should be renewed at the close of the evidence. All the cases they cite simply relate to moving to sever defendants. And there would be no policy reason why a Rule 8 motion should be renewed either. So in that sense, I would urge the court to simply apply that, review that issue as a matter of law on the Rule 8. In addition, the government has argued, and they argue this in their brief, that somehow we have to prove prejudice on the Rule 8 motion as well. I think, again, this is conflating the Rule 8 and the Rule 14 issues. I realize that happens. That happens sometimes. It happens sometimes even in case law, but those issues are distinct, as Your Honor has articulated in Coleman, which is a case that's cited by both sides in the briefs. And so those issues are distinct, and Rule 8 should still be reviewed as a matter of law. Again, there's simply nothing on the face of the indictment that indicates that there's any common scheme or plan related to this possession of the ammunition and the robbery of the postal truck. The government does argue that the offenses are of a same or similar character. Essentially, in this sort of colloquial way that, well, it's a firearms offense, this is a firearms offense, that's simply not the way that this court has addressed the requirements of Rule 8 in its own case law. It's not a colloquial inquiry. It's an inquiry regarding whether the elements charged are the same or similar, or whether the statute itself is the same statute that's at issue. And so I think in terms of assessing this court's case law on same or similar character, it's not this kind of off-the-cuff inquiry. It's an inquiry into the elements charged and the actual statutes under which the offenses are charged. And in addition, I would say, even were this court to require some demonstration of prejudice, We can certainly demonstrate that because Mr. Ross was, in fact, referred to as a felon quite a few times in front of the jury, and there's multiple cases that address why that's problematic. In addition, I would simply highlight for the court, as we did in our brief, United States versus Holloway, which is a Fifth Circuit case addressing a very, very similar issue, very well reasoned, and articulating why a gun found in a car 2 months after an alleged robbery is not sufficiently related to allow joinder in the indictment. This is a very similar issue here. We actually have a longer period of time. The arrest and the finding of the ammunition actually occurred 5 months after the robbery. One additional point I would like to make with regard to the waiver issue, the government articulates why waiver should be implied as to a Rule 14 motion. I would simply articulate to the court, even if it were inclined to require that defendants renew a Rule 14 motion with regard to severing counts, I don't believe that as a policy matter that makes much sense, because essentially what the district court is doing is allowing all the evidence to come in and the case is right about to go to the jury, and then we expect defense counsel to stand up and say, I renew the motion, so that the district court can do what? Can simply decide, okay, you're right, there was prejudice, I'm going to declare a mistrial, not let the case go to the jury. I don't think that makes a lot of sense from a policy perspective as to what district judges are actually going to do, and so in that sense, I don't think there's any particular reason for the court to try and imply its previous cases regarding regarding joinder of defendants into this element of failure to join counts, which this court has yet to address, and again, the government cites no cases on that. If Your Honors have no further questions, my time is up. Thank you.
Ms. Garst.
Your Honors, just to respond, the government points out correctly that Owens did not involve a conspiracy charge, but as far as the intricately related doctrine, we don't believe that that makes a difference here because, again, we believe that the 97-98 robberies are not needed to explain that relationship. It just doesn't fill in the gaps to complete the story of the charged crime. As far as 404B is concerned, the government talks about intent, identity, and modus operandi. Again, in order to prove conspiracy and robbery, they have to prove the elements related to the 2003 and cannot use evidence from 97 and 98 to show Mr. Wilson's propensity to act in conformity with past alleged behavior. So, again, we don't believe that they meet the first test of 404B, especially in relation to those elements. As far as the modus operandi is concerned, the government stated that Wilson assigned himself the role of planner and getaway driver. This is not correct, as the evidence has stated. Like I said earlier, Johnston testified that he was the one who called Mr. Wilson in at the last minute to participate in the 2003 robbery. So, we do not believe the 97-98 evidence sheds any light on the 2003 robbery. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Garst. Our thanks to all counsel. Ms. Garst, our special thanks to the court for accepting this appointment and ably representing Mr. Wilson. And Ms. Mather, the same applies to you and your able representation, and our thanks to the clinic for accepting this case. Case is taken under advisement.